Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee on the confirmation of Judge Neil Gorsuch to fill the Supreme Court seat vacated by the late Justice Scalia. Eric Siegel, a professor of law at Georgia State University College of Law and author of Supreme Court Myths, Why the Supreme Court is Not a Court and Its Justices Are Not Judges, joins us to discuss what he calls a charade in which Trump's candidate for the Supreme Court is not required to answer any questions that pertain to the broader political and social reality in which we all live, but rather is allowed to restrict himself to matters of legal precedent and procedure, wrapped in the majesty of the law inside a cocoon that insulates him from any real-world impact that the court's decisions might have on the lives of everyday people. Then Paul Collins, director and professor of legal studies in the Department of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, joins us with Laurie Ringhand, associate dean for academic affairs and professor of law at the University of Georgia School of Law. They are the co-authors of Supreme Court Confirmation Hearings and Constitutional Change, and we will discuss the important questions that were not answered about dark money from unknown benefactors being spent on Gorsuch's behalf and the fact that he will be sitting in a stolen seat. Then finally, we will look into whether threats from Donald Trump and warnings from Paul Ryan will sway the 26 House Republicans who so far are refusing to get on board the repeal and replace Obamacare bill that is supposed to be voted on this Thursday. An expert on health insurance markets and the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, Danya Palanca, a research professor at the Center on Health Insurance Reform at Georgetown University's Health Policy Institute, joins us to discuss whether the bill will squeak through the House to face an even more uphill climb in the Senate. And joining us now is Eric Siegel, a professor of law at Georgia State University College of Law. He's the author of Supreme Myths, Why the Supreme Court is Not a Court and Its Justices Are Not Justices. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Siegel.
Thanks for having me back. Appreciate it.
And what did you make of today's grilling of Neil Gorsuch, Donald Trump's nominee to be the Supreme Court Justice to replace Antonin Scalia?
Well, it's ongoing, so it's about, you know, five. It's ongoing today, but it is the same as always. It is a charade. It is a theater. He's not answering any questions that don't have to do with rodeo or extraneous matters, but any question that Americans care about having to do with law or cases or serious interpretive theory, he is evading and ducking, just as every nominee has done since Judge Bork. So I'm not criticizing him different than I criticize any other justices, but we're not learning anything, which is a terrible shame for America.
But it seems that these candidates are able to hide behind the majesty of the law as opposed to the reality of politics.
Well, I think that, yes, they are, and I think one of the major contributing causes to that is the senators allow them to do so. And in the ever since Judge Bork was defeated in the 80s, I think senators have pretty much decided that they don't want to get real answers because then they'd have to answer to their constituencies. So, for example, in this case, Al Franken and other senators who they ask pretty good questions, but then Gorsuch evades them and avoids them, and they don't ask good follow-up questions, and they're smart enough to do so. So I think the answer is they don't really want to get the hard answers because then they'd have to answer to the constituents in a more direct way. So the fault's on both sides. Both sides. He should feel terrible about the answers he's giving, but the senators are not pushing him to give the answers that Americans want.
But when Gorsuch says, for example, in being questioned about Citizens United and its impact by Senator Whitehouse. I mean, he was questioned about the fact that dark money is pouring into ads that are trying to promote his candidacy. And this is, I think, pretty unprecedented. I've never seen these ads before for a Supreme Court candidate. They're blanketing the states where there are Democratic senators who are perhaps vulnerable in 2 years' time. And he wasn't able to say how he felt about some anonymous person spending millions to get him elected to the Supreme Court.
And I think that's the thing. So So the way these hearings should go, I want to be clear about this, is no nominee should make any pledges, any promises to decide any case in the future. That would be inappropriate and wrong. But there's no reason they can't talk about their views on the current law or the current situation. Now, in the example you gave, I have to say I have some sympathy. I hate saying this, but I do. I have some sympathy for the nominee because it really wasn't a well-phrased question. I agree with the senator, and I think dark money is a huge problem. I think we've had these ads before, but it's a huge problem. But there wasn't really a question the nominee could ask or could answer. But it would be fair to say to the nominee, do you think Citizens United has led to this? And if so, do you think it's possible that Citizens United should be, you know, massaged to avoid this problem in the future? And he could say, I don't know, I haven't thought about it, or I have thought about it and here's my answer, or here's my answer, but of course it could change. But his answers are always that may come before the court, so I can't talk about it. And that's a ridiculous answer. And there's no ethical requirement that justifies that answer. And the senators shouldn't allow him to give that answer, but they do.
Well, White House did try to get him to talk about the impact of Citizens United, which is manifest, and how it's changed the entire political landscape and the ecology of politics. And what Gorsuch said was, well, you know, the Congress can amend the law. And that seems to be the excuse. Well, you know, I won't say it's a bad law. And he went out of his way to say how much respect he has for the justices on both sides of the opinion and praising the Supreme Court as these extraordinary people. At the same time, more or less saying, well, the ball's in your court in terms of the legislature.
Well, in the case of disclosure, that is actually accurate. And I have to say, this line of questioning, you know, is not one of the ones that I'm having a rant about. The truth is, the only reason we don't require disclosure is because Congress hasn't passed a law requiring disclosure. And in Citizens United, there were very strong indications, even from the conservatives, that they would uphold a law requiring disclosure. Now, that doesn't mean they would, but there's indications that they would. The fault here is 100% on Congress. And then we have to trace that back to the huge amount of money that lobbyists are using to convince Congress not to pass such a disclosure law. But there are limited amount of things Supreme Court judges can do about that. It is Congress's obligation to require the disclosure of public money, and then hopefully the court would uphold that. Now, I don't know if they would, but there are indications that they would.
And again, I'm speaking with Eric Siegel, a professor of law at Georgia State University College of Law. He's the author of Supreme Myths, Why the Supreme Court is Not a Court and Its Justices Are Not Judges. So what did you think then, Eric Siegel, of the questioning on Hobby Lobby, which is pretty much a signature case of Neil Gorsuch's, along with the book that he wrote about assisted suicide, which is what he terms it, others call it death with dignity. But let's talk about the Hobby Lobby. The question, I think it was from Senator Durbin, where he was asked about the impact of that ruling on the employees of Hobby Lobby, where the judge was clearly siding with the owners, these devout Christian owners of the Hobby Lobby company, whose religious rights trumped the religious rights, if you will, of their employees. And
go ahead. I've never quite gotten over the idea that a for-profit company that sells widgets can have an exercise of religion. I mean, Hobby Lobby was the first case in the history of this country where a for-profit company was given the right of free exercise. Of course, the owners of Hobby Lobby have free exercise rights. But that's a different way of looking at the case and not the one the Supreme Court did. The Supreme Court and Gorsuch, in his opinion, said that the company itself can exercise religion, and that's nonsensical to begin with. Now, I was just listening again to Gorsuch talk about this, and I think it does give us some indication, though, into his very strong religious faith, which will then obviously strongly affect his decisions. He believes that this company that sells widgets for a profit has the same free exercise rights as you or I or an incorporated not-for-profit religious company, which I do think can exercise religion. But that's not Hobby Lobby. Hobby Lobby is just a company. And so I think this is a very religious man who has strong religious views. And if anyone doesn't think that they're going to deeply impact his decisions, then they're not paying attention. That's my opinion about that.
Well, but the whole question of persons in, of corporations being persons in law, it sort of came up, but it seems to me, you know, obviously it's an old decision going back to what, the end of the 19th century, Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad, I think it was called, where corporations got personhood under the 14th Amendment. And it's obviously, people have been questioning it a lot more lately. And it seems that in this case, the way that I would wish we could find out about these people, like Gorsuch, like Alito, and like Roberts, is are you not a corporatist? I mean, isn't the law essentially, in terms of people who practice the law, you basically have people that do public interest law, criminal law, etc., and then you have corporate law, and corporate law are the big law firms with lots of money. Now, I would like to know, as a citizen, are you a corporatist? Isn't that a reasonable question?
Oh, it's a great question. And he wouldn't view himself that way. But one of the problems with the Supreme Court is that virtually all of them on both sides, not just the conservatives, basically all of them on both sides came through big firm, big corporate America. Not all, but most of them. And that is a real problem. And there's also another sleight of hand going on. The issue is not the technical legal question whether corporations have rights. Of course they do. The New York Times has rights of free speech. Your station has, if it's incorporated, has rights. That isn't the issue. The issue is, how do you balance corporate rights against whatever interest the government is trying to achieve? In the Hobby Lobby case, for example, there can be no greater interest than preventing unintended pregnancies, which is one of the great social problems in America. And that's what Congress was trying to do. It wasn't some nefarious, let's take away people's rights. It was, let's stop unintended pregnancies. To the extent Hobby Lobby has a free exercise right of religion, which I think is questionable to begin with, but even if they do, it is certainly outweighed by the desire to end unintended pregnancies. Just as, even if Citizens United has rights of free speech, and I think they do, they definitely do, the general idea that corporate spending on elections can't be regulated in the name of fighting corruption is a crazy idea. And of course, the fight against corruption should trump Exxon's desire to spend money on elections. So sometimes these debates get into the formal legal ideas of whether corporations are people, and it's really misleading. Going back to your point, though, I do think that Gorsuch is a corporatist. I think there's no question about that, and I wish he would be asked that in a serious way, like you just did.
So, I mean, if it is a charade, and it clearly is, and I don't know whether you saw the HBO movie about Clarence Thomas.
I did see it.
I found that absolutely shocking, and I understand it was pretty accurate. And the person who caved there was Joe Biden, who just, you know, the just departed Vice President of the United States. And so what is it about, you know, the political question now is the grassroots of the Democratic Party are mad at the way that McConnell treated Judge Garland. And they think this is a stolen seat, and therefore, you know, nobody should be sitting in it. And frankly, I'm amazed that none of these people have really put Gorsuch on the hot seat by saying, do you feel it's appropriate for you to sit in a stolen seat?
Senator Franken did. At least Franken did, and maybe a couple others as well.
Right.
But I agree with you.
Yeah.
I agree with you. That's a big issue.
I must have missed that bit of Franken. What did he say?
Well, he just said, you know, I know you respect Garland. You know, don't you feel that this whole process has been bad? Or I forget the exact way of putting it. And of course, what Gorsuch said was, that's politics, and I'm not going to comment on. I've been saying all along, Ian, from the very moment that Gorsuch was nominated, this is a competent, qualified, highly intelligent man. He wouldn't be my choice for the Supreme Court because I'm a liberal. But conservatives have the right, you know, to pick their people, and he's as good as we're going to get. Having said that, I think the Democrats should have gone to the mats and probably not even have shown up. I think the Democrats should have said, this is a stolen seat. You are breaking the Supreme Court. We're never going to confirm a Republican when we're in power again. This is all nonsense. And they should have boycotted it, I think. I think that's what probably should have happened.
And why not? Surely somebody must have suggested it to them.
Well, now you're asking me a question beyond my pay grade.
Right, right.
I can only assume that they thought that wouldn't play well with their constituencies. But this farce that's going on now, this fiasco, I've been following Twitter, pretty carefully today, both, you know, experts and non-experts, lawyers and non-lawyers. Nobody likes what's going on right now. Nobody likes it. So I don't understand why they just didn't say, he's qualified, he's a good justice, he's a good judge, and any other time we would confirm him. But given what you did to Garland, this is nonsense, and we're not going to play your game. That's what they should have done.
Well, that's in a sense why I brought up the HBO movie on Clarence Thomas, which is why did the Democrats fold? It seems the asymmetry here is that the Republicans are ruthless and the Democrats are gutless.
Well, if you were talking to a Republican, for example, Ed Whalen, who is a Scalia clerk and public intellectual and talks a lot about these things, he would say to you that the Democrats did not fold when it came to Judge Bork. That dramatically changed the history of the country. If you think about Bork being on the court instead of Kennedy, you can see that there would be Roe versus Wade would have been overturned. There would be no same-sex marriage decision. All of the Justice Kennedy religious decisions would be different, and so on and so forth. And he would say that was the beginning. That was the beginning. And he would agree. I think most conservatives agree, thoughtful conservatives agree, that since Bork, there has been terrible machinations and political maneuverings on both sides. It is true that the Democrats did not confirm some of the first George Bush's nominees to the lower courts, who were clearly qualified to be on that court. And this fault on both sides, and I would agree with all of that. Well, I would. I'm a liberal progressive, but I would agree with that. What changed is McConnell broke it. It was teetering on being broken, and then he broke it. And we should he did something no one's ever done before. You, President Obama, have a year left, but you don't get a judge. You don't even get a hearing. That was new. That was different. And he should have to pay the price, and he's not going to pay the price. And it's just so frustrating. It's so frustrating.
Well, of course, much is being made in the press about Gorsuch saying that he would stand up to President Trump. But Chuck Schumer, the leader of the Democrats in the Senate, said that the Senate shouldn't vote on Neil Gorsuch while the FBI is investigating Trump. So I guess he's the, what they call in the law, right, the fruit of the poison tree?
Yes. I haven't thought through that. If it wasn't for Garland, I would say no, that's not the right way to go. But given the Garland fiasco, I think that's fair. I think that's just not going to happen, but I think that's fair. I think had President Nixon nominated a Supreme Court justice in the middle of Watergate, I think it would have been a tough sell. This is not the same thing, obviously, but I think we're heading there. I hope we're heading there anyway. So I don't know. I do think we're still, we meaning the legal community, those who think about these things, and I'm sure the senators and their aides, we're still trying to wrestle with the whole Garland fiasco. I mean, do you think the Democrats in the next 20 years will allow a Republican president to appoint a Republican Supreme Court justice if the Democrats have a majority in the Senate? I don't think so. I don't think so. And that breaks the system. Because for 150 years, presidents were allowed to appoint justices of their own political party even when the other party was in power. With a few exceptions, and it wasn't a categorical exception. Nixon had a couple of appointees who had major issues, and of course we have Bork, who Democrats would say was outside the mainstream. But generally speaking, presidents got to appoint justices. The Senate Majority Leader broke that pattern, and I think we're going to suffer significantly from it for a long time.
Well, then, just in closing, Eric Segal, what would close the gap between the reality of the world and the political reality, as opposed to the abstract sort of majesty of the law kind of dialogue that comes from Gorsuch and these other nominees where they can't answer questions because of, in effect, the majesty of the law. And you were saying earlier that a lot of tweets that you're getting are from regular people who just find the whole thing absurd. And frankly, I do. I mean, what's the point of having a hearing where the person doesn't answer any substantive question and gives you kind of, you know, boilerplate?
It's a great question, Ian. I wrote a piece when Justice Kagan was nominated suggesting that because she was dean of Harvard Law School, because she was clearly going to be appointed, the Republicans were not going to fight her. What she should have said is, being dean of Harvard Law School, being a law professor, being solicitor general, I'm going to tell you the truth, which is I try to follow the law the best I can. We all do that. But in very hard cases in the Supreme Court, in abortion, affirmative action, campaign finance, religion, federalism, the law runs out. And when the law runs out, all I can do is bring my personal values to the table the best I can and hope I make the best decision. And I do so without regard to the parties. I don't take into account big, small, corporate, non-corporate. But I have to bring my life experience to the table. I thought she was in a perfect position to say that and admit that, of course, politics and fast are decision-making. But she didn't do it. And the biggest irony is Sotomayor said exactly what I just said 6 months before she was nominated at an academic conference, where she said a wise Latina would decide many cases differently than a white male because we bring to the table different life experiences. When she was asked about that at her confirmation hearing, she walked it back. She kind of denied saying it. She said it was misunderstood. It was not misunderstood. We knew exactly what she meant. But for some reason, when they get in front of the Senate, they refuse to tell the truth. All of them, liberals, conservatives, moderates, they all refuse to tell the truth. And it is extraordinarily frustrating for someone who makes their living and talks about this on a daily basis to watch this charade go on day after day, year after year. Sorry for the rant.
Sure. No. It's about as absurd as retroactive immaculate conception. And that's sort of the way it's essentially framed. I thank you for joining us, Eric Siegel.
Thank you, Ian. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Eric Siegel. He's a professor of law at Georgia State University College of Law, and he's the author of Supreme Myths, Why the Supreme Court is Not a Court and Its Justices Are Not Judges. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing the important questions that weren't answered in today's confirmation hearings of Judge Gorsuch. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Paul Collins, who's the Director and Professor of Legal Studies at the Department of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, whose research interests include understanding the democratic nature of the judiciary, interdisciplinary approaches to legal decision-making, and social movement litigation. And also joining us is Laurie Ringhand, who is an Associate Dean for Academic Affairs and a Professor of Law at the University of Georgia School of Law. She's a leading Supreme Court scholar and is the co-author with Paul Collins of Supreme Court Confirmation Hearings and Constitutional Change. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Collins and Laurie Ringhand.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Laurie, let me begin with you. What did you make of the questioning today of Judge Gorsuch? There was obviously a great deal of frustration from many of the Democratic questioners who weren't getting satisfactory answers. They felt on important issues like Citizens United, like Hobby Lobby. So we seem to be in a situation now where the questions are cocooned within the kind of majesty, or the answers are cocooned within the majesty of the law, which is what Gorsuch and other nominees have sort of retreated into, whereas the political reality, the broader reality that we as journalists and citizens are in, doesn't seem to count. So I don't know. I see this fundamental disconnect here.
Yeah. Well, I think what Gorsuch is doing is not dissimilar entirely from what prior nominees have done, but I think he is taking it a little bit further in ways that are a bit unsettling. And here's what I mean by that. What we see with these nominations, and Paul and I have studied them extensively, what we see is that nominees pretty consistently refuse, as Judge Gorsuch has, to give opinions on the day's most hotly contested issues. They're not going to talk about Roe. They're probably not going to talk about Citizens United. They are going to avoid those types of conversations. But what other nominees have done that Judge Gorsuch, at least so far, hasn't done, is they have been willing to say when they that they agree with previously contested cases that are now considered by most people to be settled law. So, for example, Griswold. Griswold is a case that established a marital right to privacy, specifically enabling married couples to use birth control without governmental interference. Nominees since the late 1980s have said at these hearings that they agree that that was correctly decided. And what that affirmation does is it signals to the senators and signals to the country that the nominee is okay with that, that they're not going to reopen those old battles. So far, at least, this nominee has not been willing to say that. What he has said about almost everything, not just currently contested issues, but issues that are generally considered rather settled as matters of constitutional law, he's refused to affirm even them. And I think that is a bit new.
And Paul Collins, what did you make of his answers to Senator Whitehouse, who wanted to talk about the consequences of the Citizens United decision, and particularly in the context of this $10 million or so that's been spent on advertising on behalf of Judge Gorsuch in states where there are vulnerable Democratic senators up for re-election? And he simply said, how do you feel about dark money and anonymous donors supporting your candidacy? And he simply wouldn't give an answer.
Yeah, I mean, I thought White House was going to blow a gasket. White House and Al Franken are probably the most frustrated Democrats on the committee thus far. I wasn't entirely shocked, as Lori pointed out, that he wasn't going to give his opinion about Citizens United, but he may pay a price for this. I don't see Democrats jumping on board to a nominee who refuses to answer some very, very basic questions being asked at the hearings.
But how do you think this plays in the broader arena when I say people like me, journalists and regular citizens, find this rather pointless? Go ahead, Laura.
Yep. I'm sorry. It's an interesting phenomena because what we learned from the 1987 failed nomination of Robert Bork, I think, is potentially pertinent here. What we learned in that nomination was, back in the late 1980s, the rhetoric against the so-called activist Warren Court was still very popular when it was conducted at that level. People liked the railing against the court. It was very, very popular and remains popular to talk about judicial constraint and to rage against judicial activism. So the rhetoric is very popular at that level. But what the Bork hearing revealed is that when you peel away the rhetoric, people actually liked most of the decisions that the Warren Court had issued. The public opinion had kind of caught up with the substance of those decisions, and that hearing revealed that that mattered, and that it wasn't enough to just be against the certain ideas about what courts do. If you can get concrete about specific decisions, you can generate a different type of public reaction. And that may be why Judge Gorsuch is being particularly evasive. He may not want to get into that type of discussion. It's much better if you're a conservative jurist to talk about theories of interpretation rather than actual results.
And Paul, I didn't mean to cut you off, but how do you think what Laurie said plays with the average public and people like myself who feel frustrated and wonder why we even go through these this apparent, well, perhaps too hard to call it a charade, but it seems to be some kind of kabuki theater.
Yeah, I think that Gorsuch's performance thus far, it's not a very positive view of the confirmation hearings to the American public. It feeds into this narrative that the hearings are something like kabuki theater, which is something that Laurie and I have been railing against in our work. And by refusing even to answer some of the most very basic questions about precedents that are in some cases more than 50 years old, it's very troubling. And I think that Senator Grassley started this by opening this morning's hearing and saying, you know, we don't expect you to answer questions about this. I think that's a very bad precedent to set with regard to the importance of these hearings for people like journalists and the broader American public.
So what is
these hearings, they provide an opportunity for nominees and senators to kind of signal what they see as the difference between cases that are settled, that are within the constitutional mainstream, that's the way senators like to talk about it, versus cases that are still open for debate. And they signal that by what they choose to talk about and affirm and what they refuse to comment on at all. And we're not getting that from Gorsuch. He's just refusing to comment on anything, which means that we can't make those types of assessments about which issues he believes are genuinely settled and he's not going to go trying to upset the apple cart on, and which ones he considers open for debate. That's a good thing to know about a nominee, and we don't have that information yet.
Well, but let me ask Paul, because you were saying that Senator Franken was about to blow a gasket. His questions were pretty fundamental. This is as far as the Democrats are concerned, this is a stolen seat. And how do you feel about being appointed to a stolen seat? And you would think on a personal level that Gorsuch would want to answer that question.
I would think so. Gorsuch seems to be presenting a view of judges that I don't think exists, this idea that judges are, you know, almost formalistic in the way that they approach cases. He keeps on saying, I will apply the law faithfully, and he refuses to comment on even the most basic thing. I don't think it would have been very difficult for him to say that Merrick Garland was treated unfairly. I don't think he would have lost any votes on that. I think it actually would have shown a little bit of empathy on his part, but he seems to have drawn a line in the sand that he refuses to cross, no matter what the question is.
And Laurie, what was your impression of dealing with that issue? Because frankly, you know, the Democratic base is basically telling its senators that, one, you shouldn't have even taken part in this thing. Maybe you should have boycotted in the first place. But short of that, you can't allow the Republicans to get away with it. So we know that they're under pressure and they're in a difficult situation. So it would seem to me that it would have actually helped Gorsuch's cause if he would have done what Paul just said.
I agree with Paul. I don't think he had anything to lose by expressing some compassion for Merrick Garland's situation. The refusal to even hold hearings, much less a vote, on Garland's nomination was unprecedented. And that has ratcheted up this this dispute. Now, the Senate Democrats, of course, unlike the Senate Republicans last year, they don't have the numbers to block this nomination, even if they force the Republicans to use the so-called nuclear option and get rid of the filibuster in order to confirm Judge Gorsuch. The Democrats can't do what the Republicans did to Judge Garland. They just don't have the numbers.
But still, it would seem that if you basically, at the end of the day, one is left with the question, since you can't really find out who these people are, which I would think would be really what's in their heart is more important than what's in their brain, and we only get to hear what partially is in their brain within the constricts or the narrow parameters of, again, I use the phrase majesty of the law. I can't think of a better way to put it. But wouldn't it be interesting to know, for example, how do you feel, Neil Gorsuch, about taking this seat under these conditions? You know, is this a case of, I mean, why are you doing this? Why, I'd like to know whether this is driven by just sort of unbridled ambition or a sense of duty to the nation? I think these are legitimate questions.
I agree. It would be interesting to get his position on exactly why he wants the seat. It would be nice if he showed a little bit more candor on many of the questions that he asked. He seems to have this view of judges that puts them up on this pedestal. And given some of the things that he said, I'm skeptical that he actually believes that. And so he demonstrated in an offhand comment that probably only academics got, he demonstrated great familiarity with legal scholars, sort of these obscure legal scholars like H.L.A. Hart, for example. And so I'm convinced that he has a lot of familiarity with more realistic views of judging than that of which he's presenting at the hearing. And these views of judging suggest that things like empathy and compassion do play a role. And it would be nice if he would speak a little bit more to that or to it at all.
Yeah, and this problem is bigger than just what happens at the confirmation hearing. A lot of the political discourse about constitutional law has gotten trapped in this kind of umpires versus activists paradigm. But, you know, constitutional law is, or constitutional cases are hard. And Supreme Court cases, the ones that get all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, are the hardest of those cases. They don't have simple answers. They don't have single, obviously correct answers that a judge operating in good faith can just go out and find. Supreme Court justices deciding difficult constitutional cases have to exercise judgment. And how they exercise that judgment can be shaped by their life experiences. It can be shaped by their views of what the judicial role is. It can be shaped by their views of different methods of constitutional interpretation and how to balance those methods against each other when they lead to different results. All of that is baked into our constitutional cake. And it's a fallacy to talk about judging at that level as if it's math. It's not.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, let me ask Paul first and then Laurie second. Just in closing, do you think, though, that it's a good idea to have people like Gorsuch, irrespective of his views, that comes so much out of the law and is so immersed in the law, as opposed to somebody like a Sandra Day O'Connor, who actually worked in the legislature and understood what the legislature is about? In other words, can we have some people on the Supreme Court who have different real-life experiences as opposed to an entire career, either usually in corporate law?
I would prefer it. I don't think we necessarily need an entire Supreme Court staff of people with various types of political experience, but I think having a few justices who have some more real life, more political experience could be very useful. And I'm thinking of folks like Earl Warren and Sandra Day O'Connor. I think they bring a unique perspective on the bench that helps the other justices on the court, those justices that are from a more law specific background, see cases differently and process them in ways that might not be quite as obvious to those justices coming from straight law careers.
And Laurie, what's your opinion on that?
I think when Sandra Day O'Connor was the last person to sit on the court who had any experience as an elected legislative officer. And I think the court really lost a valuable perspective when she left. And specifically, we see that in decisions that the current court, when it has what sometimes comes across as almost a contempt for legislative processes. It seems to want legislators to work and function and make decisions the way courts do, and then slaps them down when they don't follow those types of judicialized procedures in their decision making. I think that's a mistake, and it would definitely enhance the decision-making value of the court if they had that perspective back again.
Well, I thank both of you for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Paul Collins, who's the Director and Professor of Legal Studies in the Department of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, whose research interests include understanding the democratic nature of the judiciary, interdisciplinary approaches to legal decision-making, and social movement litigation. And also joining us was Laurie Ringhand, who's the Associate Dean for Academic Affairs and a Professor of Law at the University of Georgia School of Law. She's a leading Supreme Court scholar and the co-author with Paul Collins of Supreme Court Confirmation Hearings and Constitutional Change. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into whether threats from Donald Trump and warnings from Paul Ryan will sway the 26th House Republicans, who so far have refused to get on board the repeal and replacement of Obamacare. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dunja Pelenka, who is an assistant research professor at the Center for Health Insurance Reforms at Georgetown University Health Policy Institute, where she analyzes state and federal health insurance market reforms, including implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Previously, she was senior counsel for health and reproductive rights at the National Women's Law Center. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dunja Pelenka.
Thank you for having me.
And Donald Trump and Paul Ryan seem to be pulling out all the stops to try and overcome the fact that, as I think we're speaking now, there are about 26 Republicans, House Republicans, who aren't going to vote for the repeal and replace bill of Paul Ryan's. And Trump is warning them that they're going to pay, basically threatening them, I would think, from, you know, you're going to face some real payback in your districts. And Ryan is appealing to them, saying, you know, this is our promise, and we ran on this promise, and you can't violate this promise. So my sense is that it's probably going to pass in some form or other. So is this the dynamic then, Dunja? As they make more compromises on the bill, is it likely then to satisfy the far right, the Tea Party people, is it likely that the end product is going to be less user-friendly and in the long term basically create a kind of backlash amongst the American people who will end up with something even worse than what Ryan started out with?
Well, I think to begin with, what they have started out with will result in pushback from the American people, as 14 million people will lose coverage next year under CBO estimates. But definitely, as they try to make change a lot to bring the conservative members on board, the conservative members want changes that will actually take coverage away from more people, which will make the coverage even worse in some ways. They want a total repeal of the Affordable Care Act. And I do believe when Americans experience what that is, that there will be much more pushback on those members.
So do you think they'll meet the Thursday deadline?
The way it's looking right now, they may very well not have it passed if they do vote on it on Thursday. There are still some Republicans who do not support it because too many people will lose coverage. And there are some Republicans who still say they do not support it because it doesn't go far enough to repeal the Affordable Care Act. So you have people wanting the bill to go in two different directions.
Well, apparently Trump, you know, in these closed-door meetings in the with the House Republicans today, basically, supposedly, you know, would use carrots and sticks, you know, charm and admonishment and singled out some of the skittish members. How much is this a sort of referendum on him? Because it's, you have to admit that the hearings that took place yesterday with the director of the FBI and the head of the National Security Agency, they weren't real helpful to Donald Trump, to say the least.
I mean, the promise to repeal the Affordable Care Act is a promise that has been made by Republicans in Congress long before Trump was president or even running for president. So this is very much, I think, a piece that is much larger than Trump and has really, you know, the Republicans in Congress have taken this upon themselves to be something that they have been pushing forward and moving forward. And I would actually say right now it seems like we're having a referendum more on the Affordable Care Act and the expansions of coverage and the protections it has than having a referendum on one person.
Well, then, but you know, one of the problems here in the United States is that there are two universes at play, roughly speaking, the universe of Fox News and the universe of the mainstream media or MSNBC or whatever, you know, where there are two completely different narratives going on. And there's no question that over the years, the Republicans have effectively demonized the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, as they prefer to call it. And I'm wondering how that dynamic is playing out in the broader landscape where, you know, you basically have, the way I see it is you have, the demonization has been very effective, but yet you have these town hall meetings with where regular constituents are confronting their usually Republican representatives saying, don't mess with the Affordable Care Act. So I guess the dynamic at play is how much longer can the demonization play in the real world, and how much can the supporters of the Affordable Care Act mobilize?
Well, I think outside of a real base that the demonization of the Affordable Care Act has already stopped working to the same extent. Support of the law has been increasing. And as you mentioned, there has been, you know, incredible turnout at these town halls. People who, you know, who support the law are really mobilizing. And people are also starting to learn more and more that the coverage they have is because of the Affordable Care Act, or the protections they have, the fact that their child, you know, coverage didn't max out, that that actually was because of the Affordable Care Act. Some people weren't aware that they had those changes happen, and now that they really see it as something that really might get lost, it seems that people are actually starting to realize what's there and starting to support the law more. And in comparison, when you look at the polling data on the American Health Care Act, which is the bill that's going to be voted on Thursday, that has very low support right now, even among, you know, Republicans and Democrats, that it's really not just a just Democrats, and that the Republican, the polls show that the Republican voter support of the American Health Care Act is very, very low. So there really is the mobilization and the passion really right now. It seems to much more be those people who want to protect access to health care.
And again, I'm speaking with Danya Palanca, who is Assistant Research Professor at the Center for Health Insurance Reform at Georgetown's Health Policy Institute, where she analyzes state and federal health insurance market reforms, including implementation of the Affordable Care Act. And previously, she was Senior Counsel for Health and Reproductive Rights at the National Women's Law Center. So then, assuming that there's a vote, and as you mentioned earlier, it may well not be on Thursday as planned, and assuming that they manage to overcome this deficit of 26 Republican House members and make the compromises necessary, then it has to go to the Senate, where it's an even more uphill climb, isn't it? I mean, we may find a situation where it only passes by one or two votes, and then it enters the Senate, where you've got hostility from one poll, from Rand Paul, who Donald Trump singled out when he was in Kentucky at his rally and tried to pressure him, but to no avail from what I can tell. And then you've got other, what seem to be more reasonable Republicans, like Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, and who basically doesn't want Medicaid to be eviscerated and is actually concerned about the health of her constituents. So am I correct in suggesting that even this thing limps out of the House, it's going to be facing an even tougher uphill battle in the Senate?
I think that is definitely correct. I think from the beginning, it's been very clear that there were some moderate senators who are very concerned about the Medicaid cuts. And I believe that those CBO estimates for 24 million uninsured really helped cement some of the concerns for, it seems, for some of those senators. We don't have full commitments from those senators. Things may change, but between that as well as the opposition from those who want a total repeal or close to total repeal, it's going to be very hard to pass something from the House that will get the, it seems that it will be very hard to pass in the House that will get the 50 votes that they are looking for in the Senate right now.
So then you don't think at the end of the day they're going to have the American Health Care Act is going to make it?
You know, it's hard to make that projection right now. It's clearly at risk, and Paul Ryan is making changes, trying to get the support to get it through. There is a possibility that it will pass. We don't have a situation where we have 10 Republican senators saying, no way will I vote for this. The numbers are small, and we're really going to probably be close to 50 in the Senate. So if it gets through the House, is still a possibility that it will pass.
But what about the warning, say, from Representative Chris Collins, a Republican of New York, who said, quote, if the Freedom Caucus kills this bill, which they could, then they will have voted to continue Obamacare, which, as the president pointed out in 2018, probably means that we would lose the House and the Senate. So that seems to be Trump's warning. Ryan's warning is a little different, saying that we made a promise which you have to keep. But what do you think of that particular warning? Is that, I mean, it's so confusing here, isn't it? It's the demonization of Obamacare that seems to be the best selling point. And how dare you not go back to that on the one hand. And then there's the idea that it's just going to be too cruel and there's going to be too much of a blowback when you throw everybody off Medicaid.
I think, well, first they're between a rock and a hard place because they talked about repealing Obamacare for all of these years without having a real plan on how to replace the law. And what they are finding is that it is not very easy to do that, and especially in such a quick period of time to try to put together a replace plan. That really is why we have the American Health Care Act, is we haven't had the months go in that went into developing the Affordable Care Act. And also the American Health Care Act goes much further than repealing Affordable Care Act, where it really does significantly restructure Medicaid and puts a lot more of the responsibility, the fiscal responsibility, onto the states and cuts Medicaid significantly, so that a lot of the cuts in insurance rate in the future years are people who lose Medicaid coverage. And that includes children, people with disabilities, seniors who are in long-term care. All of these people are going to be facing risks of Medicaid cuts under the law. And when people are looking forward to sort of what's going to happen with them when it's election time, there are certain threats of, yes, there are people who promised to repeal the ACA, but they didn't promise, or most of them did not promise, to cut Medicaid. Some of them actually promised to protect Medicaid. And even if they promise to repeal the Affordable Care Act, it's a very different thing when their voters in their district start losing that coverage.
But isn't Ryan really, he seems to be ideologically committed to killing Medicaid. And he did, in an interview recently with Hugh Hewitt, he basically crowed about the idea that finally we could actually stop what they call an entitlement program. And frankly, that I don't understand how the word entitlement has become a pejorative, because people have paid in and they are entitled. I mean, but nevertheless, they've managed to make entitlement a dirty word. So that seems to be the kind of Ayn Randian thinking of Paul Ryan's. And how much do you think, if I'm correct in that, is this driving Paul Ryan? In other words, he's trying to be pragmatic to get this thing passed, but isn't he essentially an ideologue?
His budget blueprints for multiple years, for many years now, have been moving towards cutting Medicaid, have been moving to put caps on Medicaid. And this clearly is a policy idea he has been wanting to move forward. And I think he has seized this as an opportunity to do that or to try to do that. I don't know if he will be successful with it, but that definitely seems to be where we are right now, is that he is pushing forward this idea that he has raised in his budget, but that we're never going to get the signature of President Obama.
Right, but he's basically, in his Hugh Hewitt interview, said finally we're going to actually stop a program and cut spending, and it's as though he really wants to eviscerate it altogether with these block grants as opposed to, you know, give it a lifeline.
I think that's true in some ways. I think it's definitely true that he does want to cut the spending of Medicaid over time, and it does go to, I think, some of the ideological differences we have seen between those who want to make sure that the most at risk in our country have access to health care and other services they need, and those who just talk about the mantra of small government.
Sure. Well, just in closing then, let me just turn briefly to this extraordinary situation in Texas, where the Texas Senate have passed a bill allowing doctors to keep information from pregnant women. It's called the so-called wrongful birth bill. Have you heard about it? And it just seems pretty extraordinary to me.
I have heard of it, and I would say it comes following a number of laws across the country and states that have not just aimed to restrict access to abortion, but to restrict what doctors can tell patients. So some states have passed laws that actually, require doctors to say something to a patient that in some instances is not even medically accurate, or to require patients to have ultrasound that's not medically necessary. And this is, logically it does flow when you start to have those types of laws, that the next step is allowing doctors to keep information from patients. I think that's generally, for people's health, I think a very scary situation when you are allowing doctors to keep information from a patient. And in this instance, it's particularly to women's reproductive health.
Well, the bill is aimed at preventing women from aborting children that could be that will be born with disabilities like Down syndrome. So, in effect, the Texas Senate is basically keeping information from women so that they'll be forced to have children with disabilities, which they'll have to take care of for the child's life. That's the bottom line, right?
Yeah, it's unfortunately putting the decision in the doctor's hand instead of the woman's.
Sure. Well, I thank you for joining us, Danya Palenka.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Danya Palenka, who's assistant research professor at the Center for Health Insurance Reforms at Georgetown University's Health Policy Institute, where she analyzes state and federal health insurance market reforms, including implementation of the Affordable Care Act. And previously, she was senior counsel for health and reproductive rights at the National Women's Law Center. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.